Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Sandy Griffin. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September 1st, 1989. And I have a home group, and it's the Keystone Group, and it's on Sundays. It's over. It's at 5 o'clock at Chippenham Hospital. And it's, in my humble opinion, it's one of my favorite meetings. It's my favorite meeting. And there's a story about that. When I first got sober, I think I had around 10 or 12 home groups because I carried resentments. Go figure. And I would end up being at a home group for like 2 weeks and then would hate everybody and they weren't doing what I thought they should do. So I'd go get a new home group. So I've had this home group for, I think, 13 or 14 years now. So, yay. Yeah. My home group's happy about it, too. And I have a God today that I, a higher power that I choose to call God that I never had before. I never had a reason, probably. I never thought about it before, but I have a God who loves me very much, who loved me even when I was drinking. But I never knew that, and I'm so grateful today. I have a sponsor who I've had since I got sober. I got out of treatment. When I was in treatment, I met this woman. We used to come downstairs from the hospital when they allowed patients to go downstairs to an AA meeting. Today, everybody's on drugs, so they just roam around. They don't let anybody do that anymore. But I saw this woman, and she was active. She was cleaning ashtrays. I didn't even know about this, but I just saw this active woman, and I went up to her and asked her. And that's been over 19 years ago, and she's still my sponsor. And she's sober today, and I've kept her that way. Because that was my job. My job. But it's a relationship that I never thought I could have with any human being. Never. But I feel so close to this woman. She knows everything about me. She knows everything about me, every move I make. She knows I'm up here tonight. And it's something that I never had before in my life. I can't even explain it to people, but you know. You know what I'm talking about if you've had that connection. And I'm so grateful for it. Now, there have been times during my sobriety that I thought I needed to get rid of her because just like home groups, you know, I would get resentments, or I thought that I needed a so guru sponsor, and I've just been blessed with, I have someone who I still want what she has, you know, and I love her to death, so I have that, and today my life is different. I'm different. You know, the circumstances around me are still the same. The world has not changed, but what happened in 19 years, and it took time. My perception and my attitude towards life and towards God and towards His children has changed. And that's the miracle that I'm here standing before you. You know, that I have changed. My heart has changed. Something happened inside of me. And I can't tell you the day that it happened. I don't even know when that happened. But something changed inside of me. And I know now today that, you know, it's through the 12 steps and the traditions, you know, that I had no idea what I was doing. None. You know, if you're new here, and I don't know how many people are new or renewed or old and new or whatever, but I had no idea what I was getting into when I came into these rooms. And the things that were told to me and asked of me to do, they just didn't fit the description of what I thought was, that step is not going to get me a job. That step isn't getting my family back. You know, where does it say on there I was going to get a car? Those are the things that I came in with. I came in thinking that that was what a sobriety was all about. So I came in, and it was at the end of August. And what happened to me is my life ended up in the toilet. And the world was crumbling and crumbled. It just crumbled all over me. It was like quicksand. I was going down. In fact, I had already had seizures. I was really at death when I got to you people. And how I got to you, and I'm going to tell you in a general way exactly how that happened. I was born in Petersburg to the youngest of six, to a nice Jewish family. And it goes like this. I'm 58. It goes 58, 59, 60, 61, 67, 68. My mom was busy. And she is not an alcoholic, even though that sounds alcoholic. to me, it does. But what happened is when I was a kid, the only thing I can remember growing up is that I was fearful. I was just a fearful kid. I would see my sisters and brothers who seemed to have it. I don't know what it was, but they had it. You know, they were smart. They were pretty. They seemed to know how to talk to people. And I, on the other hand, was just in fear. I didn't know if I ever did anything right. I never felt like I fit in. I always felt a little separated from them. But I wanted what they had. I really did. I wanted what my sisters and brothers had. I looked up to them. And so fear guided me all through my life. Even when I first got sober, fear ruled me. I did things really around that. So at the age of 15, I took my first drink. So here, this fearful kid who never felt like she fit in, who was always wound up very tightly, you know, willing to do anything to get your approval. I wanted my sisters and brothers and my mom and dad's approval so bad that I lied for it. I stole for it. I cheated for it. I would have done anything for them just to say they love me. Because that's all my life I wanted, to love and be loved. All my life. And so I was willing to do anything for it. So at the age of 15, when I took that first drink, not the first one, because of my first experience, I blacked out. That should have told me something. But when I first took that drink, that it happened. The magic happened. All that went away. You know? I felt like I could talk to you. I felt like that I could, it gave me the courage to do the things. It gave me courage to be with my family. It gave me the courage to laugh and to have fun. So who wouldn't, in their right mind, pursue that? You know, I knew nothing about alcoholism. I just knew when I took that drink, something happened to me. And I was going to pursue that with everything that I had. And I will tell you, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. I wasn't quick about anything. You know, I never realized any of this. This is all hindsight about alcoholism. But I started drinking at the age of 15. And also, I want to mention that at the age of 15, back in the 60s, I was a fat kid, and all my sisters and brothers were thin, so my mom thought it was necessary to take me to a diet doctor also. And so back then they gave out, you know, diet pills like they were candy. And yummy. They were good. And so at the age of 15, I was on these amphetamines. And what it did for me is I just drank faster. You know, it just gave me, you know, something to, you know, I just washed them down, you know, with alcohol. So I was at the age of 15, pretty much not in my right mind. And but I was good at hiding. I was a sneaker. I was sneaky. And I carried a lot of shame about drinking because, see, my family didn't drink. So I immediately thought that there's something wrong with that. I didn't really know people who drank, you know, the way I was drinking. I know during the holidays, on the Jewish holidays, on the Seder dinners, you know, everybody would have the Manischewitz wine. I know it's disgusting, but they would leave it and everything, and I would just go around drinking it. I really did like sweet drinks, and probably that's where I got it from. But so I did things sneaky. I wasn't a closet alcoholic, but I started off that way. I started off going to bars. And because at the end I never went to a bar to drink. Mm-mm. But at the beginning I would go to bars, and before I would go there I would have to drink. Because And I didn't think about this. I didn't think that there was anything wrong with it whatsoever. I just knew that I innately knew that I wasn't going to get what I thought I needed. So I would drink before. And when I got to the bar, everybody would have their what they had, and I would just be well on my way. And then I would go home and finish the job. And I was doing this, but I was still maintaining my work. I moved up to Washington, D.C. by this time. And, you know, from Norfolk, that's where I grew up, from Norfolk to D.C., man, that was a big difference for me. I mean, people did a lot of things up there. It was fast. And I'm a fast kind of a woman anyhow. You know, I was on amphetamines, so I was fast. But I just did things quickly, and I like that. I like that kind of pace. So I was living up in D.C., and at the age of 21, everybody in my family got married because that was the thing to do. Back then, you were considered an old maid if you didn't get married. And also, my family, and even still today, I'm sure people think this, that if you get married, that's going to settle you down. Or that's a form of security. Or, you know, you really have made it. So, everybody in my family got married at 21. So at the age of 23, I decided I better do this. You know, my family was kind of pushing me and like, what are you doing with your life? Which was nothing. And so I picked out this perfect specimen. I picked out a nice Jewish doctor. For a couple of reasons. One, my family, oh my God. Oy, it was the right thing to do. Big Jewish wedding, everything would be great. So, you know, the guy was really nice. He's a nice man today. And so we got married November 9th of 1974. And back then, my parents spent $20,000 on this wedding. Back then, even today, that's a lot of money. But back then, that's a lot of jack. So, before I got married that morning, my girlfriend picked me up, and I was thirsty, you know. Didn't really know that I was irritable, restless, and discontent. I would have never used those words. I was just thirsty. So I started drinking that morning, and I remember my girlfriend, we riding around, and every hour in the hour, we'd pull on the side of the road, you know, because I had to throw up because I was not a pretty drunk. So I threw up a lot. And I remember her looking at me and she goes, you know, Sammy, you don't have to do this. You do not have to get married. And I'm like, yes, I do. You know, she knew. She knew I was doing this for all the wrong reasons. So I was the last one to show up to the temple. And I drank a fifth of vodka that day and took four Quaaludes. And I was all right. I would have, you know, I say this now, but I would have married anybody that was standing beside me at that time. But I was okay. You know, I walked down that aisle just fine. It was exactly what I needed. But here's the sad part about this whole thing. I was only married for 3 weeks. And the reason is, and I'm not going to do a fifth step, but I will tell you, this is the type of person that I was. I saw another guy go by that I liked better. And see, I was the type that if I was through with you, I was through. I didn't care what the circumstances were. I just tossed you away. And what I did to get out of that marriage, what I told my family, because God knows I got to come out smelling like a rose. I got to look good and be good. Is I lied about him so much. That by the time I finished talking to my parents that day and my family, they were glad I got rid of him. And it was all a lie. See, I had to lie to make myself better. And I did that. And this was at the age of 23. I mean, I could have used a sponsor, you know. I really wish I had a sponsor to call. But I didn't have that. I didn't have the skills that everybody else seemed to have to make decisions, to have convictions. I just didn't have that in my life. It wasn't in me whatsoever. So that was just another day in Sammy's life. I just, you know, tossed away. Eventually I would toss my bills away like that, you know, people for sure. But anything that I didn't want to feel or to get near, I just threw it away. Not knowing that I was building up this stuff inside of me. Not knowing that hurting other people and disregarding their, being inconsiderate, and was going to catch up with me like that. So that was just another day in my life. I got sick. I was working at NIH at the time, and I got sick, and they put me on disability. And the reason I mentioned the disability is because for two reasons. One, I've never been self-supporting on my own contributions. I was never self-supporting. And two, it gave me a reason to drink more. Because, see, whenever something happened to me, or, you know, my solution to everything was just take another drink. And like I said, I didn't know that. I really didn't know that. I just knew that alcohol was going to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. I couldn't face life successfully at all. I had no idea what that was about. None. So that was in, I think, yeah, somewhere late 70s, I was put on disability. So what that did for me is it started making me, and I say make me because alcohol ruled my life. It really did. All my decisions at that point were based on alcohol was making all my decisions for me. I started traveling the United States, not because I wanted to, because I had to. Anytime I ended up in a city and I became friends with you, I would end up causing trouble. I was the type that just stirred stuff up. You know, I was in there and I was just stirring it up. I was an agitator, and I was having blackouts, and I was doing things that I don't even remember what I was doing. But I was just a selfish, selfish young lady. And so I've lived in quite a few cities. I've lived in New York, Philadelphia. I lived in Florida a couple of times. I lived in Tennessee. I was just moving wherever the wind blew me, wherever my suitcase, which was a garbage bag, you know, would allow me to go. I went. I would end up sleeping on your couch for a year, you know. You know, thinking that I was having fun. Because if you would have asked me what I wanted to do all my life, what is your goal, Sammy? What is your goal? What is your ambition? I had none. None. I was just the most, I just didn't have any plans. The only thing I wanted to do was have a good time. I wanted to have fun. Fun was the answer. Now, see, I grew up, this is with my family being very educated. All my sisters and brothers today are all doctors and lawyers. They all went to, you know, a couple of universities, graduated. They had husbands. They have wives. They have children. You know, they have, like, you know, these lives that I would look at and say, why don't I have that? Why don't I have that? Why don't I have that white picket fence? That house. How do people do that? I couldn't figure it out. I would look at people like, how do they own a car? See, someone would give me a car. You know, I never had what I saw other people had. And I would go around faking it all the time. Like thinking that I owned the world. That, you know, and I was always trying to prove to the world I was important enough, for goodness sakes. But I would look at my sisters and brothers and I would end up having to lie what I was doing and where I was going and what I was being. Because, see, I wanted them to love me and I wanted to be equal to them or better. But I felt so much less than. So much less than. So, I don't know what age I was, but my dad got sick. And, you know, I think I was in Tennessee at the time. I don't know. That was a strange place. They talk funny there. No offense, Debbie. Yeah. She's from South Carolina. And so my dad got sick, and he got sick with mesothelioma from asbestos. And my goodness, you hear it on TV so much today. So my mom wanted to take a break. She really did. She needed a break from all this. And so she asked one of her children if they would come help her. And I raised my hand. I volunteered because, see, I wanted to be a good daughter and I wanted to be a good sister. I really wanted to be that good person. And it made sense that I did it since I was doing nothing. And, you know, my brothers and sisters were busy. They have families and occupations and, you know, that other stuff. And so I went down to Houston. That's where they sent my dad for this protocol. And my mom got to go back to Norfolk to take a break because she needed it so desperately. So I go down to his to MD Anderson in Houston, and they set you up in the same room. I'm sleeping in the same room with them because that's what they do. And I go in that room, and I'm feeling a little restless, irritable, and discontent. And I'm getting a little thirsty. So I don't think anything of it, and I look at my dad, who can't speak at this time because he's aphasic. And, you know, he can't say anything. And I look at him, I said, "Dad, I'm going to be right back." And I go out to have one drink, just one. And I knew that's all I was going to have. That's that obsession. I mean, I lied to myself all the time, but I didn't know that. So I went out in Houston. They got a lot of bars. And so I went out, and I had one drink. And I didn't go back to my dad's room for 3 days. And I get back to his room, and he looks at me with that look like, "Where have you been? What are you doing?" You know, that look that you just, "I don't know what to do with that. I just don't know what to do with it." So my solution to anything like that is to go have another drink, and I did. And I go back 2 days later, and he gave me that same look, but the nurse came and got me this time, and she was, "Sammy, your dad's dying. And we're going to call your sisters and brothers and your mom because they've got to be here really soon." And how typical of me. I thought to myself, "Oh my God, they cannot see the condition my condition's in. No way. No way. I'm out of here." You know, I didn't stop to think about my dad. I didn't stop to think about my family. I was just so fearful of my sisters and brothers that I left that night. I just left. And my dad died. And I didn't even get to say goodbye to him. Because all I was doing was thinking about myself. You know? What am I going to do? What are they going to think about me? What do I think about me? You know? So I got out of there. And so at the funeral, I fly down to Norfolk to go to my dad's funeral. And how do I go up? I get there. I show up drunk to my dad's funeral. And my sister grabs me, and I have a sister with long fingernails, and she just grabbed me with those nails, and she just spit on me. And she said, "We don't want you here." You know, and I just, like, flicked it off. I'm like, "Oh, she must be kidding," you know, blah, blah, blah. So I stayed, and I stayed to help my mom out. Because my mom, after the funeral, you know, all the sisters and brothers, everybody left, and I volunteered to help my mom. And I did the same thing to my mom. You know, I was out every single night. Some nights I didn't come home because the drink had me. And I didn't know that. I would have never told you that that was my problem. Never. I didn't know. But I was out, like, I would have that one drink, and I didn't know that that compulsion, you know, that craving was going to take over. I had no idea. And I would just come home days later, and she'd give me that same look. And so I ended up leaving my mom, too. And I ended up in Florida. And at Florida, you would have thought I had my life made. Oh, my gosh. My oldest sister said, you know, she wanted someone. She decided she wanted to open up a food store. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is, it's got my name all over it. So I flew down there. We drove down there, took all our belongings. And she came from New York. And we drive down to Florida. We're in Naples, Florida. It's gorgeous. She buys a brand new condo. I'm on a golf course. I love golf. I play golf. I couldn't at the time because I couldn't even see the ball, but I was playing. All I had to do was wake up in the morning and just roll out of bed and get onto the golf course. I had everything I needed right there. But I took a drink, and that drink took me. And I ended up leaving my sister in the middle of the night. Didn't leave a note, nothing. Just left her in the middle of the night. And because things caught up with me. Because I would cause trouble. You know, I was just an agitator. And so I ended up in, that's how I ended up in Richmond, Virginia. And I get to Richmond, and I ended up being a bartender at my sister owned a bar called Poor Richard's, right on Carey Street. And I became a bartender. I'd never become a bartender before. That was exciting. as a good bartender. Us having blackouts, I think for, I was there for a few years, I can't remember how many, but for a couple of years, I don't really remember. For years, I don't really remember too much of anything. And what happened during that time, I was doing a lot of illegal things, with money, and it got caught up with us, and my sister ended up losing her restaurant, and I had a lot to do with that. And so I end up leaving there, and I start working at this place called the Village Cafe, and it was a place in the city where the girls and the guys that worked there were all kind of freaky looking, you know, that goth time where the women wore really white makeup and dark lipstick, and they dressed in black, and I went, oh my God, I'll fit in great. And no one will notice me. And people notice me. And what happened there, this is what happened. I was drinking every single day. I would, sometimes I would sit and, you know, in my apartment, my little apartment, which I didn't pay for, you know, the government was taking care of that. I was living in this efficiency type place, and I would sit there, and I remember I would drink literally day in and day out, and we had a fire alarm, and I remember the fire department came, and I'm sitting there with my bottle right next to me, and I'm not moving. That place could have burnt down, but I wasn't going anywhere. I remember looking outside the window, and the fire department, you know, they're evacuating the whole building, and I'm not going anywhere. Nowhere, because I wasn't leaving that bottle. But I would go to work, and some days I would say to myself, I would call in sick, and I would come up with the, you know, these elaborate excuses. Instead of just saying I don't feel well, I'm not coming in, I would say I cut my hand off. You know, I would say these stupid, you know, absurd, you know, excuses. You know, but luckily enough, the guy who was my boss was an alcoholic, a recovering alcoholic. And he knew what was going on. You know, because I used to look back like, God, why did he keep me there? But what happened was, my boss had put up a camera to catch someone stealing. He didn't tell me he'd put the cameras up because someone had been stealing from the register. Y'all already know what's going to happen. So I come in on a Friday, and he calls me into his office, and he sticks in the VCR tape, and he plays the VCR, and he catches me stealing from the register, and I denied it was me. I was just a little left of the center. You know, my brain cells were shot. I couldn't even make a complete sentence. I couldn't talk. I was just brain dead. And he looked right at me when I denied it was me, and he goes, Sammy, you need help. You need help. And, you know, and I just thought to myself, this was my thinking, I'll just take my poker chips and move to another table. That was my thinking, you know, because, you know, I have these 9 lives. I'm going to land on my feet no matter what. Now, by this time, I had been fired from other jobs before. There's a lot of stuff in between. You know, I don't talk about men that much because men were just, you know, a little side attraction, you know, for me. If I wanted one, I got one, you know, and I didn't really care because the drink was more important. For years, I had discovered drinking alone. I didn't go to bars anymore. I was in that little teeny apartment, and when he said, you know, you're fired, you know, I'm letting you go. I didn't really hear those words, but that's what had happened. He didn't call the police. You know, he didn't do anything because he could have. And I get in my car, and this is the condition my car was in. My car was in the same condition I was, trashed. You know, it had retread tires. It hadn't seen oil, you know, in a long time. In fact, the week I got sober, my car died. You know, when I was in getting out of treatment, it just totally just died. But that's the condition my car was in. I go back to this apartment that I was living in, and my apartment was trashed. You know, I hadn't let anybody in there in years. I hadn't had a friend or family in years. Because during those probably 2 years prior, I'm just guessing that, when I was working at the Village Cafe, my family had typed a letter to me saying that they had killed me off. And in the Jewish religion, what they do is they take their sleeve and they just rip it, and you're considered dead. And they sat Shiva, they did everything, the rituals of the Jewish tradition. And what that letter did to me is it killed me inside. Killed me. I mean, any light that God had turned on in me was going out. And it gave me more reason to stay drunk, that's for sure. So he fires me, and I go back to this, to this apartment that's trashed, in my trashy car, and I'm trashed. And the condition that my condition was in is probably for 30 years I wore this headband. I was a hippie. And I never took my headband off. And I also I had stopped bathing for a while. You know, you hear that in stories, you know, I was attractive. And I wore the same long sleeve yellow sweater that I wore in recovery for a while too, and it was real long and just covered me almost from head to toe. And I had these flowers in my hair and that headband. You know, they were dead, but they were still in my hair. And but what I would do is I would go to my apartment, and that's where I stayed. And after he, you know, let me go, I go up there, and something happened. I didn't drink, and I just fell asleep. And I woke up that next morning, and something happened to me. And I know today it's the hand of God that touched me. I know that. But I didn't know that then, but when I woke up, I knew something was different. And what I did is I got on the phone and I called my best friend that I grew up with, her sister, because I knew that her sister's daughter had gotten help somewhere. And I didn't even know what I was doing, but I called her and I said, I need help. I didn't realize that those were going to be the most important words that came out of my mouth. Because that's one of the hardest things that I hear most people do. I don't care if you're a newcomer or an old-timer or a sometimer. I need help is one of the hardest words that we can say. And I said, I need help. And she came over right then and there. And I'm going to say this every time I speak because it's so important. She didn't say, Sammy, wait until American Idol is over, or I'll be there, you know, after I feed the kids and do all that. She goes, I'm going to be right there because, see, that was my window of opportunity. That was it. And so she came right over and picked me up, and she took me to treatment. I didn't even know what I was going to treatment for. I had no idea. And so I just said, okay. I didn't know that those words were going to be one of the most spiritual words that I could possibly say was okay. I just know that I was done with me. And so she takes me to treatment, and I go up to Tucker's. I'm a Tucker nut. And I go up there, and I knew it was at the end of August, so I used September 1st. I knew it was clear on that as my anniversary. And they told me that I was a late-stage chronic alcoholic. And I was like, I was so happy. I was so happy to know that there was a problem that I didn't know. I honestly didn't know. And it talks about that in Chapter 3 of our big book. It talks all the different kinds of ways people come in. Some people know that they're an alcoholic. Some people have it branded on their forehead. I had no idea. I thought I was mentally ill. I told the nice psychiatrist that came to see me. He was so nice. I said, I think I'm schizophrenic. And he goes, that may be true. You know. And he goes, I'm sure you have a couple of people talking to you. But I did. I thought I was just mentally ill. I remember during my drinking times that I would get a glimpse of myself in the mirror. You know, I would just see and I would just be taken back because I swear I saw the devil. I had horns on my head. I mean, that sounds weird. But I would curse myself. just like in Bill's story, I cursed myself a weakling. You know, what's wrong with me? What is wrong with me? So this kind doctor and my counselor, who was a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, told me what was wrong with me. They told me that I suffered from a spiritual disease. And I was like, ah, I was so happy. You know, I was with 28 other people, and a lot of them were not happy to be there. So I was pretty obnoxious, you know. I was like, woohoo, we have a solution, you know. And I was one of those people that as soon as I got here, I was done with Sammy. I was done. And see, I was just thirsty for the knowledge. I was thirsty. Just like I was thirsty for that drink, I was thirsty for the knowledge of how am I going to not drink. How do I live sober? And so what treatment did for me, and it was a good thing, is they introduced me to you people. I went downstairs, and that's where I met my sponsor. And my sponsor, what she did for me, to me, I don't care what word you use, I don't care about those words, but I know what happened to me, is she took me by my hand, and she walked beside me, not in front of me. She showed me by example of exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. And what she did, and it's so funny because, see, I needed an event. You know, I needed a happening. I needed my family back. I needed a job. I needed all these things. I was a whiner, as you can tell. I whined about everything. But I wanted these things to happen. And she would say, why don't we go pick up this girl down the street? And I'm like, what? I don't want to go do that. She doesn't really want it. I mean, why are we going to go? Ugh. Well, I ended up living with my sponsor for the first year, which was the greatest thing for me. Because left up to me, I don't know what would have happened, but I don't need to know what would have happened. All I know is I was shown by example. My sponsor woke up, and she prayed. She prayed. My sponsor to this day writes every single morning a 10-step. She has, you know, and she throws it away every year. She keeps it for a year, but she was a writer. And I would see by example what she did. She would go to meetings, and she would clean up. She was so active, and she is active in, you know, her service work. And so I would do what she did. I didn't know why I was doing it, but I just did what she did. My sponsor believed in the steps. She believed that the sooner you did them, there's a chance that you may not drink if you do the steps. And I didn't understand that at the time. I never heard these words before. I never really heard surrender or powerlessness. Those were all new words to me. I mean, it was a whole different language here. You know, when you're new, and I remember that, and the Big Book tells us that we want to put yourself in the newcomer's place to see how you would want yourself to be treated. And I remember that all the time because when I first came here, it was so odd. The language was different. So when someone new comes in, you know, we're like, oh, let God. And I'm thinking to myself, what? You know, let go of what? You know, what I got is good, right? Well, I was explained, and it was just explained to me and shown to me truly powerlessness. Because my sponsor would give me example after example of her powerlessness. See, I couldn't get it together. I couldn't understand all that. All I know is I just didn't want what I had, and that's all I needed to know. I just needed to do what was in front of me. So we went through the steps, and whether I understood them or not, it's not important that you understand them, it's just important that you do them. So my sponsor was real big on this step too. She felt like, she goes, if you're powerless over this alcohol, and I wasn't sure about that at the beginning. I just wasn't. If you're powerless over this, physically and mentally, and if you believe what the Big Book says about that and you hear all these stories, if you're powerless over alcohol, then you better get a power that's going to take care of you. And see, I didn't have that power. The only power I had was Sammy's power, self-will, which is my spiritual disease. My self-will is my disease. My self-will gets me in all the trouble that I can get in. So I suffer from self-will. And so I would look at her. I would just stare at her. I would just like, I don't understand a word she's saying. But I would do it anyhow. She said, you need to get this God. And, you know, I never even used the word God before. I don't even know if I ever said the word. And it wouldn't even come out of my mouth. It was just stuck here. So what happened was she told me to go in my room and start practicing God, talking to God. And I thought that was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard. She goes, just talk to him like you're talking right now. And I'm like, okay. I would go in my room and I'd start having conversations with God. And I don't know what day it happened. I can't tell you. You know, but I know that it came into my heart. You know, I knew at first that I, just like in the big book, it says, I think, and you came to believe, and then he knew. And that's the road that I took. I thought it. I wanted. I would go to meetings like, how do you pray? What do you do? How do you do it? What do you do? Because I was thirsty for the knowledge. I had this willingness, and I'm so grateful for it. You know, and I wanted to be honest, too. I wasn't real good at that, but I was as honest as I could be at the time. And so I'd go in my room and I'd start practicing, and that was the key word for me. I had to start practicing these things. If I wanted something to incorporate into my life today, I practice it. You know, I'm a big sports person. I love sports. If I want to be good at it, I got to practice. You know, so it was the same theory. I could identify with it that way. So I started practicing, and God went from here, from that thinking, into my heart. And see, today I know. I know that God's taking care of me and taking care of you. I know that that spiritual disease that I suffer from, that I can do it myself, that I'm in charge. That's the disease. And I've learned over time that all I had to do was just give it to God. You know, I sponsor a lot of women today, and I love it because I hear the I need this, I want that, I can't do this, I. And I remember my sponsor saying, it's going to happen for you when the I goes to the I. And it does for me today. And, you know, I know that God's in charge today, and that's what I suffer from, you know, before and sometimes today, that that's my spiritual sickness. So one of the most, I think one, not all of the steps are good, but I think one of the most rewarding steps, and I hated it at the time, was step 4. I hated it. You know, I hated to see me. I hated to see the truth about Sammy. You know, I didn't want to be selfish like that. I didn't want it to be at such an extreme that I was sarcastic, that I was inconsiderate. I didn't want to be all that. You know, I liked painting my pictures. She's so nice. You know, she'll do anything for anybody. And that was not me. I mentioned this when I talked because this is the kind of person I had become. When I was working at the Village Cafe, I fired someone for stealing when I stole it myself. I mean, that's how I had become. So, seeing the truth about Sammy is what set me free. See, today I know this because I've done this. And the big book says I can say this because it's something I've done. I see the truth about me. I have accepted the truth about Sammy. And see, I can do something about that today. I can't do anything about you, but I can do something about me. I can turn it over to God. You know? And so when I had to swallow the big chunks of truth about me, and like I said, I was like 3 months sober, and I cried like a baby. I was a big crier. I cried all the time. And what happened is when I got to 6 and 7, my sponsor was really, she's today, is give it to God. God's going to take care of it for you. Just give it to Him. And I started practicing that. You know, I didn't come in, you know, and get well quickly. You know, some people say I'm not even well today. But I will tell you, I'm standing here a different person. I had to make amends to my family. And I didn't want to do that because my family had disowned me and I was just a mess about it. And they wouldn't even answer the phone when I called. So I had to write letters to my family on this amends thing. And I made amends. I mailed the letters and my sponsor said, expectations are out of your vocabulary. And I said, okay, all right, that's no big deal. Well, I didn't hear back from them after a week and it killed me. And I just thought that I was going to be the prodigal daughter and the red carpet would be out and all forgiveness, but there was none. And I'm going to mention this because I think it's really important because a lot of people do have this with family. My family did not forgive me. And even today, and it's been over 25 years, last September I got invited to my mother's 90th birthday. And for the first time in over 25 years, I got to see my family. And I'm telling y'all, when my oldest brother called me and asked, you know, told me that I was invited, the words that came out of my mouth was, okay, I'll be there. You know, what didn't come out of my mouth is, what, after all these times? After all this time? See, I knew it was in God's time. I know now. See, I thought it was in my time. I thought it was in their time. See, God had to heal my heart. He healed me. And so I could go there with my head up. I took you people with me in September. I took every one of y'all with me. I went with an old timer. I said to an old timer, Jack C. came up to me and I was with him that day. And I said, oh my gosh, I'm going to see my family. He goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. He goes, Sammy, all you have to do is suit up and show up. God's already paved the way. I didn't have another worried bone in my body. I show up there, and I, like I said, I took you people with me, and it was a gift. I mean, God was there. My husband was there, and I walk in that room, and there was over 100 people of my family, all my sisters and brothers, not all. One wouldn't go because I was there, and that's okay. I didn't want her to feel that uncomfortable anyhow. If it was so uncomfortable for her, I'm glad she stayed away. But I held my head up. I didn't, that shame that I'd been carrying for so many years about what I did. Look what I've done. Oh my God, look what I did to my sisters and brothers. I did some, you know, they didn't disown me because I was an alcoholic. They disowned me because of my behavior, because of my alcoholism. And see, that was the difference. And all that, those years, of course they helped me. I'm sure they're not going to forgive me. Look what I've done. But when I walked in that day, it was gone. It was gone. And I could be Sammy for the first time ever in front of my sisters and brothers. Was I well received from them? No, I wasn't. Did it bother me? Yes. Because, see, I still have feelings and it still hurts. But it doesn't take away the part that God has restored me. He has given me a life. And I've got gratitude. I was grateful to be there. I was there for my mother. I was there for no other reason. And so I left there just thanking Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanking God for the life that I have today. Because I didn't have to crawl before anyone. I just had to be the best Sammy. My sponsor told me that since day one because, oh my God, I want to do everything she does. And she goes, whoa. She goes, Sammy, I want you to be the best Sammy you can be. I don't want you to be a little June. I want you to be a Sammy. And see, from that point on, I could follow my own dreams. I could do things that weren't in front of me. And see, that's what God had intended for me from the beginning. All my life, I wanted to be happy. And what I got from that, from being sober through Alcoholics Anonymous and a God of my understanding, is I got to have a life that I never even dreamed. Never even dreamed. You know, that guy who fired me from that job, from that bar, 2 years later, I was paying him monthly. Money orders because I couldn't have a checking account because I was a code six. But I was paying them through money orders. And after 2 years, he called me and goes, Sammy, you don't owe any more money. You don't owe me any more money. Would you come work for me again? So I became a dishwasher at his restaurant. You know, and this Jewish girl, that was all tough. But I became a dishwasher, and 11 years later, I was the owner of that restaurant. So this is a person who has no ambitions, no nothing. But what you people have taught me is all I have to do is suit up and show up and do the next right thing. You know, I don't know how all this happened for me. I know that I sponsor women. I've had, my spirit has been awakened. I've been going to prison for 17, 18 years now. I work closely with my sponsor. You know, I make coffee. I go to meetings. All these things that I do in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is my life. You know, that is the center of my life. God and AA and everything else gets added in there. I don't know which one did it for me, but I'm going to keep doing it. Because what I've got, I'm very content with. Today's is a day that I can honestly tell you that I like being Sammy today, and I don't have to be you. I don't have to just do everything you do and do that. I can be Sammy today and be very content with what I have. And I want to thank you so much, Billy, for having me speak.